May I now in our first speaker for the day, Aisha Kidwai, to begin. Over to you, Aisha.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me, Advija, Sarah, and everybody else. And thank you for joining in large numbers to listen to what was, along with Delhi University, I think perhaps, the story of one of the first anti-sexual harassment committees in Jawaharlal Nehru University. I have a presentation because it's a 20-year-old story, so it can frequently take a lot of time, and I'm a teacher, so I can't stop talking. So I will not cover everything that I've got in the slides, but then you can just read it as I speak along. But I can't share I had a set of slides, if you would like me to share them, otherwise I can speak without them too. I'd sent it to you, Sarah, but I'm not being allowed to share.
Yeah, let me just do that. I'll share your slides from here. So you can just let me know when you want me to skip ahead. Yeah. Advija, you're the host and you have to enable screen sharing for me and for all of us. Actually, if you just enable it, I think Aisha would be able to use her own.
Yes, I think that would be. If you can give me permission.
I am not the host.
The host is Shailja.
Yeah, I think Shailja needs to do it.
Are you able to do it now?
Yeah, I'm just, oh dear. No, I think it's better that you share it because it's not allowing me to
sign in. You make me the host, please. Yeah, I can do it now. So,
yeah, we can start.
Sorry, this is a little. Okay. Can everyone see?
Yes, Sarah, we can see the screen.
So I'm going to, I'll start without any further ado. I'm going to talk to you about the experience of Jawaharlal Nehru University, which I've been a part of, and as a young assistant professor, this was a movement that we started shortly in the wake of the Vishakha judgment. And I want to talk to you about the experience of setting it up and the experience of losing it. But I'll try and keep the experience of losing it as small as possible. So, because it's painful and it's also, that story isn't over yet. We're still fighting. So, next slide. So, the GS Cash, as we call it, was formally instituted in 1999 at the end of a two-year-long intense struggle by JNU students and teachers. And the demands of that movement for this, which at that point we didn't have the name, that was only instituted after we won. And the demand was for, in the wake of the Vishakha judgment in India, which recognized that there existed the beast called sexual harassment in the workplace, and it was a genuine human rights violation, was the demand was for a popularly constituted through election, either direct or indirect, a body that was representative of the entire campus community. So it had would have students, teachers, non-teaching staff, workers, unions and associations, but really nobody from the administration. And we wanted this committee, in the struggle, we were clear that we wanted it to be popularly elected and fully autonomous of the university vice chancellor and other people from the higher echelons of the university administration. Because we are a residential campus, it was also important for us to have wardens who were the people who did the firefighting on the ground when sexual harassment events took place. And we wanted this, it seems like an impossible thing in today's, we believe that that the decision of this committee would have to be implemented, obligatorily implemented by the vice chancellor and the higher administration. Next slide. So what we also wanted was not just a body, but a gender sensitive and impartial inquiry process that guaranteed both confidentiality, support and dignity to all parties, and was free and insulated from the pressure from senior levels, a phrase that the Vishakha judgment uses. And this body would not only do inquiry, it would also do sensitization of students, staff and faculty. And now it seems a little strange to talk about this and to speak these words now, but at the point that we started our agitation, the idea that sexual harassment was the correct description of what happened to women, it was completely outlandish. Either it was a women's problem, with a problem with no name, as we used to call it then, or it had to be called a very specific Indianism called Eve teasing. And everybody would call it Eve teasing, including, you know, women. They wouldn't want to call it sexual harassment because that somehow implicated their consent or participation or drew attention to body parts that were preferably occluded from view. And we also wanted this body not only to sensitize, but then people who needed help to be able to be given counseling, what we wanted was basically everything that we want today. Now, the good news is that for about 18 years, we had it. So next slide, we decided that we wanted a popularly elected body. Could we do the next slide, please? Our understanding of this from these 2 years of intense agitation was born both from an understanding of what a university is and what kind of a workplace it constitutes, and specifically an Indian university. So there are different levels of hierarchy at university. So there's teachers versus students, and there's officials and the contractors and union leaders or powerful opinion makers within a community. Then there's all levels of seniority and juniorness. And each of these, so it's not one chain of command through which power flows and then in one direction and resistance can flow in the direction opposite. So it also mattered what religion you were from. It also mattered what your caste was, whether the harasser was somebody of your of a higher caste or a lower caste, whether the harassee was somebody who was upper caste or lower caste, and rural background, etc. So the usual route for constituting these committees like this, which had begun to be adopted even by 1998, the UGC in India edition, was to institute a community that, or the committee that comprised the hierarchically powerful, so vice chancellor, rectors, and every single hori, and they're usually gentlemen, would be on these committees, and they would issue pamphlets, right? But what it also did was exactly the same hierarchies that were channeled in into creating the sexual harassment event in the first place were the hierarchies that were going to be now responsible for inquiring into the workplace, right? And so while these, so they managed the what happened inside the committees and dealt with the sexual harassment event and the outrage that followed. And outside, they let these patriarchal and hierarchical power relations actually have free reign. So if we could move to the next slide. And so the DNU DS Cache and the Delhi University committees just broke with this tradition completely. By 1999, we all got 1999, 2000, we all got the committees that we wanted. And we said, so in DNU, I can speak more authoritatively about DNU, is that we said we wanted elections because the issue of gender-based violence and sexual and gender-based discrimination cannot be dealt with by just instituting a committee. Rather, a public dialogue process where sexual, even the term sexual harassment would become current, so that elections actually ask people to put their credentials on display. And that once you're in the committee, you're going to be bound by the oath of confidentiality, so you guarantee complainants confidentiality, and every member of the elected committee is going to be equal. Okay, so next slide. So there was that you had to actually institute processes and procedures whereby this would be these differences would be leveled. They come inbuilt into university system. And what we did was, you know, include unions and associations, because I'm sure that many people of my generation, and I think every generation subsequently and before, can vouch that, you know, it's these bodies, which are collectives again of the powerful, usually, are the ones that play very big roles in sexual harassment events. And so we said, well, rather than, you know, doing it out in the public space, and which then would directly affect how the complainant life and progress through a sexual harassment inquiry would entail for the complainant. We said we bring it into the committee. We will have our disagreements, and we will have, but then, you know, we will level out. So the committee both became a site for actually undoing, or at least on the matter of sexual harassment in the workplace, undoing the hierarchies that existed, but also a place where equal contestation could happen. And let me tell you that for many, I was associated with GS Cache until it was wound up. And this was one of the central tensions that we had to deal with. Okay. Also, you know, by keeping administration out of the committee, we ensured evidence independence for the committee. And basically, we had to keep nobody informed. We had to do what was right. It sought to maintain confidentiality for both the complainant and the respondent, because it had to be fair until the inquiry proceedings were over. And then thereafter, also complainants' names were never revealed. But because the GS Cache usually in cases of quid pro quo harassment recommended fairly stiff penalties, and there was no confidentiality on the claim for the accused. So that was by virtue. But it also created another level of separation, so that the inquiring body, there are different rules for different constituents in the university who's under which jurisdiction. And so teachers cannot be just fired or by anybody. There is a body called the Executive Council can do so. So what we did was separate the inquiry function from the from the executive's disciplinary function. And our role, and we asked, and we demanded answers if punishments or penalties that we suggested were not going to be implemented. Right? And what we also did, which I think was very successful, particularly in the initial years, in creating a public culture where people knew what a sexual harassment was, and that we could take the insights that we got from complaints and channel them into our sensitization activities. So, yeah, could we go to the next slide? Right. So at the point that was wound up in 2017, and it was also an open document, an open committee, so the composition was changed to become more inclusive, and there was another round of changes being contemplated. Was that there were, you know, this was the kind of representation that we had in the committee, the current composition of GS Cash, because we don't believe it's over. Right? And two or three things I just want to flag here is that there were two, what we also sought was to bring in the expertise and experience of the women's movement directly into the committee. There were many ways in its 18 year career, that this was done, but was two eminent women academicians from outside the university, people who had specific experience of dealing with sexual harassment in university spaces, two representatives of an NGO, and the coordinator for counselors. So next slide. And what we did was in the inquiry procedures, at the end I'll give you the link to where all are the development of our procedures. So we have a website which archives what we could of the GS Cash. Right? But what we did was in the inquiry function, specifically try and level the hierarchy that obtains there. So in a case where student versus student or student versus teacher, if there are only faculty and people of a higher institutional powers, we made it mandatory that on an inquiry committee against a teacher, that if the complainant is a student, the student had to be represented. As a member of the GS Cash who was a student had to be part of the inquiry committee. And unions and associations, because they are bound to represent many more than just if complainants and accused people, that they could not be members of unions and associations. They couldn't be a part of the inquiry committee, right? But they could participate in the deliberations about the final penalty, etc. Okay. So could we move on? And I think I'm just the next slide. I'm just going to talk to you about the notion of the process that we developed, which are very explicitly detailed. I remember sitting in Vrinda Grover's office as a distinctly black-haired young woman, working for days with her on what would be our notice, our notion of what is a fair inquiry procedure. Teachers are not lawyers. We know that if we're going to act against employees, that we must be very, we should do legally sound and fair inquiries. And that, you know, the prevailing assumption in the university, this was now already, 1 year since GS Cash, was that because this committee was for the first time in India, 50% women, and women, as we know, or as men know at least, was that they will not be particularly reasonable, that they would not, that they would respond without fairness because of knowing, because of their past experiences. That we needed to lay down procedures that gave guarantees of impartiality and confidentiality that were real. But once that built into the process, notions of we knew how sexual harassment events take place. And even if there is been no actual sexual harassment event, there is a certain trope by which the way the events panned out. So usually the event would be one-on-one with no eyewitnesses. There would be some build up to the event. So there would have been some past indications. And with the complainant saying no, our committee was gender plural, so therefore we men could complain too, and that the woman could, but the woman usually confided in a few friends. Shortly after the event, because of the existence of a complaints mechanism, what would happen, particularly if the event had involved physical contact and advances, there would be an attempt by the perpetrator to apologize. And usually, whenever it was not accepted, a tremendous intimidation from every section of the community would follow, from students, from fellow colleagues, from families, which were usually a big deterrent. And once the complaint, nevertheless, if the complaint nevertheless got filed and inquiry began by GS Catch, then immense slander would follow. I think in the first 5-7 years, any ongoing complaint details would mysteriously find themselves leaked to the press, and so that the committee would be slandered. So that a sympathy for the complainant, for the respondent or the accused would be roused, right? And there would be tremendous hostility.
Aisha, I'm so sorry for interrupting, but can you just wind it up in like 2 minutes? Maybe we could take more of this in the question answer.
Right, right. And so the inquiry process was made into into something which is a further harassment. And so what we did was, I think we can just leave this here because I won't go with the slides anymore. What we did was, over the next 10 years of the GS Catch, make these procedures such that there was fairness, that there was, that the procedures gave women the rights to the principles of natural justice. Because everything that existed in the system at that point was one that was stacked all the odds against women. And this was particularly since 2012, this committee was going very well. In 2017, September 19, 2017, by order of the Executive Council, the committee has been wound up. It has been replaced, this elected component is almost virtually completely gone. The problem that was seen was, of course, faculty, the elected faculty, so that people, you know, like me and many other of my colleagues could stand and win elections. Those committees were gone. Now, JNU is officially sexual harassment free. The committee that has replaced it doesn't seem to find anybody guilty of sexual harassment. Complainants are being routinely punished. And we lost something, which, you know, were it not for today and this gathering, I would have been very despondent. I mean, I was despondent when I was putting together the slide, because it seemed that there was nobody who could now learn from this experience. But I think that the fact that this is happening today, and that we are still talking about what are correct mechanisms for, or appropriate mechanisms, is really a sign of hope, because outcry and protest doesn't work for every complainant. There are many more complex issues now than there were ever before, particularly in this online world, and that we are still, you know, fighting for the restoration of our institution. But thank you so much for giving me an opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm sorry if I was long-winded. Sorry, apologies.
No, Aisha, not at all. In fact, you're just in time. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing your journey of setting up GS Catch and for bringing out the nuances and complexities of the process, you know, so well, from setting it up to making it work. And I'm sure we'll return to the question answer session. We'll see more discussion on this. Just a small announcement before I invite our next speaker. Participants, please post your questions on the chat box. Please keep them short and succinct so that we'll have, we can take up more number of questions. Yes, may I now invite Vrinda? Over to you, Vrinda. Yes.
Thank you, and good morning and good afternoon. And really, as Aisha said, thank you for organizing this. It really does keep one's own hopes and energies alive and going to see that these are that there are others out there who are going to carry these battles forward. And as Aisha said, we haven't given up. It's just that we are going through a rough patch, and we are fighting our way through that. I just want to pick on a couple of things that Aisha mentioned here, and I think it's important for those of you who are planning to take this plunge in your own universities and other areas to know that people like Aisha and many of her colleagues have a day job. They teach, and this then becomes their 24-hour job. The university doesn't pay you to do this. This is really part of feminist activism, which allowed for the setting up of something like GS Cash. It does not come out of either a university or a law. This is what the feminist movement has contributed towards and has taken forward as part of its politics. And I think it's important to underline that, because far too often the credit for such things, and even though I'm a lawyer, I feel the need to say this constantly, we give far too much credit to lawmakers and to the courts. These things do not materialize because of that. There are those who take this forward where the broad arc of feminist politics, democracy, all comes together. And then we see the beginning of conversations and change in cultures. And we know that those are intergenerational struggles that we are all part of. I'm going to take forward and come more in the sphere of law. And as was said earlier, so what happened with the Vishakha judgment, many of you would be familiar with it. And so I'm not going to tell the story except to underline two things. Prior to the Vishakha judgment, there had been other instances. One important one which the judiciary took note of, and didn't, not in the in terms of sexual harassment, but otherwise, was the case of a woman police officer from Chandigarh, Punjab, called Rupan Deol Bajaj. There's actually a very interesting video interview of hers available on BBC. I'm happy to share the link. Rupan Deol Bajaj talks about her legal struggle against a very senior, very powerful police officer of Punjab who had sexually harassed her at a party. And despite being a woman police officer and of a senior rank, she had to fight all the way up to the Supreme Court, where it was acknowledged finally that she did suffer sexual harassment. Then we have the case of Bhavri Devi, gang rape case. And while Bhavri Devi has yet to get justice from the court, I think she in her own journey has moved on and has contributed in a way which has changed the life of women in India and elsewhere by the Vishakha judgment, which builds on her experience of violence at the workplace, sexual violence at the workplace. And the Supreme Court in 1997 hands down the Vishakha judgment, which draws upon international law, CEDAW, which India had ratified, and leans upon the Constitution. So what it does is to place sexual harassment within the framework of the Constitution and looks at sexual harassment as an act of discrimination and inequality. And therefore, it's not just a workplace issue. It's not just a women's issue. It's a constitutional issue. And every act of sexual harassment, it says, is an act of discrimination against women. So in India, we look at sexual harassment as falling within the domain of constitutional law as well as labor law. What it provided us, as was said by Aisha too, was a vocabulary, a legal vocabulary, because we didn't have the term sexual harassment even in our legal lexicon. And what it does is to provide a definition and elaborates by and gives a very open-ended, inclusive, illustrative, but not exhaustive definition, which I think is very, very essential when we're dealing with issues like sexual harassment, to leave it open to other experiences that may have to be brought into sexual harassment with time. And that definition also set a normative standard of what is prohibited conduct, which really is the purpose of, is one of the purposes that law serves. Today, of course, we do have since then both a statute which was brought out at the protection, the Sexual Harassment of Women at Workplace Prevention, Prohibition, and Redressal Act of 2013, and also a provision pursuant following the Justice Verma Committee recommendations in the Indian Penal Code, Section 354 capital A, of the Indian Penal Code, which penalizes and makes a criminal offense of sexual harassment, and that is not confined to workplace, is sexual harassment per se under the IPC. I'll just quickly say a word on that because I'm not going to revert to that again. There is a difference of opinion even within India whether sexual harassment should ever have been made a penal offense. And there is substance and arguments on both sides. I would only bring one illustration to your mind because of the nature of sexual harassment that we have to understand. It can actually be an offense where, and this is a gender-specific offense, it's an offense where the man has probably never touched a woman, but you can create absolute hell for the woman who is working with you or under you. And invariably, there is a hierarchy in which it operates. And it can be just through communication, conversation, which, and we know for a fact that many, many, many women leave jobs, leave cities, leave education institutions because of sexual harassment. So it's not just one of those things that we can shrug away. The infamous case of R.K. Pachauri, who has since died a few months ago, who headed a very important institute and was also heading an important panel in the UN, the climate panel. He headed an institution called TERI for over 25 years. The woman who finally lodged a complaint against him actually could lodge the complaint only under Section 354. Capitally, of course, that proceeding will now have to abate with his demise. And this also links to the issue of governance. If you're going to keep the same man at the top of the institution, give him all powers for 25 years, the likelihood of abuse of that power is inherent and inbuilt. So these things cannot be divorced from how you're going to democratize governance of institutions. But coming back to the sexual harassment, as I said, we got a definition, we got a vocabulary. Very important in the definition was the quid pro quo element and the hostile work environment element, which also then indicates that this is not about every single woman. Women experience sexual harassment as a class. The direct comment may not be, the comment that is made, which is offensive, may not be, or derogatory, may not be directed at that particular woman. It may be something that is being said in the lunchroom between male colleagues, but it impacts women as a class. And that's an understanding that in India is gradually developing jurisprudentially. The other aspect that it brought in was how it is linked to favoring either detrimental treatment at the workplace or some implied promise. And the definition tries to understand the nuance that is inbuilt into sexual harassment and how its power play actually manifests itself at the workplace. So that definition, I think, is very helpful. The way it's defined in our present statute is atrocious, but that's just the way legislative drafting has been done in India now for some time. I'm sure there is a more coherent way to put it together. The elements there are very, very important and can definitely work for almost any jurisdiction. The other thing it brought in was to bring the Internal Complaints Committee, of which I can't think of a better example of how building on Vishakha, G.S. Cash came about. And I don't think even the Vishakha judgment had at all envisaged something like G.S. Cash emerging from there. And that's why I keep saying it really is what the feminist movement brought into it on its own. But it did say there'll be an internal committee because women really are not about to rush to the police, but they need to work. And they need to have a workplace safe environment. And the duty and obligation is trust on the employer, just as it would be for preventing, say, a fire hazard in a building is also the job of the management and the employer. The unique part again, which fortunately was retained in the law, there are some setbacks that the law has made, and I'll come to that shortly, was that in understanding the nexus that may operate, it asked both to cut the nexus within the office or the university or any such workplace. It introduces the outsider into the committee and also what is called the internal complaints committee, but also says that the outsider who comes in must carry an expertise either in women's rights issues or in understanding sexual harassment. It can't just be the boss's best friend coming in, although examples of that kind are rampant, and I think GS Cash today probably reflects much of that. So what was originally and what the law says that this expertise and experience is crucial for your qualification in that committee. What perhaps happened more in universities but almost didn't happen in offices and other workplaces, industry, was that the role of this committee was not only to adjudicate complaints when they come forward, but the term that Aisha used was to change the public culture. And therefore the law actually says that you will conduct workshops, you will sensitize, but you know, that's not seen as something that offices should commit themselves to, spare time. So very few actually did that. And the committees became more like adjudicatory complaint processes rather than doing preventive and long-term change in the way work cultures are operating. And I think that gap continues even today. What the law did when it came into 2013, and this to my mind is a huge setback, was that instead of self-nomination or some form of democratic processes of whatever nature in an institution, workplace, office, for people who will sit on that committee, it said that the employer will decide who will be sitting in the committee. And to my mind, this is extremely regressive, and we have seen the impact of that since 2013. This whole, there's always been in India an inherent belief that the man on the top, and it is usually man on the top, and that's why I say that in an office, the man on the top knows best. It's my understanding that this notion really comes from our Indian society being so deeply casteist and hierarchical that it believes that the person on top knows best, and that person will therefore decide who will sit on this committee. Few days ago, in fact, less than about a week ago, news has come in that the head of the National Law University of Assam has been making obscene gestures to the neighbor. And there is now a police complaint against the head of the National Law University in Assam. So this is the man to whom the law has entrusted the responsibility of setting up the anti-sexual harassment committee. And that is precisely the problem with giving this kind of role and not keeping it open within the workplace. So that's something that we need to guard ourselves against. In terms of the process, again, I think the law and the Vishakha judgment gave a good process, which was vastly improved in universities through their own set of experiences by bringing in, the law says there should be a definite time frame. Invariably it isn't there, but the law at least gives you that peg to hold on to. There is transfer that a woman can ask for. There is leave that is accorded. All these, understanding that this is going to take a toll, particularly when you're going to file a complaint. What I have at least seen, particularly through my legal work in court, is that a lot of complaints and committee hearings get stayed by the High Court because they do not follow to the T, the principles of natural justice. And this, I think we should really, as Aisha said, when they drafted the rules, every single thing was written down, but that is unique to JNU. This process was not necessarily followed across the board. What we do see is, while there is some kind, even when you are sympathetic, empathetic, in solidarity, unless you're going to follow principles of natural justice, court is going to block those inquiries, they're going to set aside the inquiries. So it doesn't, in my view, and I know this can be taken amiss, it doesn't help to be over compensatory to the woman without being fair, because that will not hold in appellate proceedings. So it's best to literally embed the fairness code into. Having said that, the fairness code is not the code that the law usually follows. that fairness code has to be gender sensitive, gender attentive, and that's what we have been doing, at least in India, where cross-examination is not allowed directly. Certain privacy concerns are taken on board. So while one should look at natural justice, the natural justice forms that have traditionally existed, including, say, in England, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, those today have to be made gender-sensitive to the concerns that play out in sexual harassment. I'll very quickly move on to, it provides a range of penalties because the misconduct of sexual harassment can range from a comment, a WhatsApp, to actually sexual assault. So given the broad spectrum of sexual harassment, therefore the penalties also range from a censure to counseling to dismissal. And I think that that range is very, very important to retain so that one can understand it in its entirety. What we are noticing today, and I want to quickly jump in here, is the backlash. And that backlash is not just because of the reasons which are particular to, say, an institution like JNU, where we are as a country experiencing a pushback to more regressive, fundamentalist, autocratic, authoritarian ways. But the backlash is also to feminism per se and to women's rights per se. And therefore, you have slap suits or defamation cases, civil and criminal, being filed against women who speak out. The patterns that have emerged, again, are something that I think are very valuable to think about. When in many cases, including in the R.K. Pachauri case, when one woman makes a complaint, many women come out, even though those incidents of sexual harassment may have taken place 10, 15 years ago. This actually was laid bare in the Weinstein case, for instance, where even women who were very well prominent actors had kept silent for decades. So these are patterns which we are yet to absorb into our processes, but they are emerging, and I think those patterns are now, we can see the trend clearly, we need to absorb them into our processes, that women may speak late, very late. So limitation law should not apply in cases of sexual harassment, because there could be multiple reasons why the woman has stayed silent. Women do find strength and confidence in numbers. The truth is that women who complain, regardless of what happens in there as a result of the inquiry, they invariably leave that particular workplace. Sometimes because they no longer can deal with what has happened there. Even when they have won cases, they have chosen to leave that workplace. These women face very severe unemployability, and that stigma, and it passes, and how it passes, and I'll tell you from the experience some of my clients have had, very often when you apply for a new job, it's the HR department which talks to the HR department of your previous employment. And the HR department passes on this piece of information very innocuously, and that becomes the one reason why you don't get employment. So even as we work in parallel processes of internal complaints committee, the HR departments need to be brought into the loop and need a different kind of orientation also, because there is women are facing high unemployability. During the period of COVID and even otherwise, women are largely in the unorganized work sector. The nature of your contract, the tenure that you have, is directly proportional to whether you are going to make a complaint or not. If you are a daily wager, if you're a contract laborer, you are not going to make a complaint of sexual harassment because the likelihood of losing your job is 101%. So when we read, there are many, many, you know, from the World Bank to every other person talks about women's rights. Women's rights are directly related to the nature of contract of employment, and we need to factor that into our advocacy. I'll just take 1 or 2 minutes. Sorry. Okay. I was on the backlash with civil and criminal defamations being filed. I myself faced a civil defamation from R.K. Pachauri for speaking out on behalf of two women. Media gags again work against women. And we need to, therefore, when we talk about slap suits, we talk about it largely in with environment movement, human rights movement, and the issue of how women were speaking out against sexual harassment needs to also be brought into the broader human rights concerns. The Me Too movement, of which we saw some instances, quite a few instances coming out in India too. Again, what did it bring to our attention? It brought to our attention the limitations of law, that law in itself was not providing the avenue. So there is always need to reflect, revise, and as I said, there are today patterns which have emerged. How do we take these patterns into our processes, bring them into the jurisprudence of sexual harassment? And therefore, I would suggest that we always keep we have to be attentive and sensitive to what is happening on the ground and what are the experiences of women. And the last thing, the very last thing I'm going to say is, in many universities, offices, workplace, there is a growing conversation today that should sexual harassment policies only be looking at what happens to women? In India, for instance, today offices are being encouraged to bring in give employment to transgender persons. We know that they are subjected to very, very severe harassment, including sexual and sexualized harassment and sexualized violence. My thought on that is that there are many forms of harassment that take place in an educational institution or a workplace. Of course, it is not just sexual harassment. Bullying also of various forms take place. I'm putting this out to hear from people, the option that is usually offered is make it gender neutral. Just say sexual harassment of a person. I personally don't think this is the best way forward. And I think when we are making things gender neutral, we are being gender blind. I think that manner in which sexual harassment is directed towards people of different sexual orientation, different gender identities, has its specificities. And we need to take those into account when you design the committee, when you design the process. And therefore, it should not be gender neutral, it should be gender specific. Protection should be provided to all, but in gender specific terms rather than gender neutral terms. Thank you.
Thank you, Vrinda. Thank you for that eloquent speech, replete with case studies, and for drawing attention to the systemic and structural issues that plague the functioning of the ICs, be it training and sensitization of committee members or the power dynamics that operate to deny justice to survivors. And I think most important, whether law itself is a limiting factor. Thank you so much. I now invite our last speaker in this session, student activist from Pijratur. Please unmute yourself. Yeah.
Yep. Hi. Okay, so first of all, I'll go a little fast because I'm not sure how much time I have. So stop me if I'm speaking too fast.
You have 15 minutes.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, I'd like to start by introducing what Pijratur is. It's basically a collective that works on campuses, mainly in Delhi, and especially on North Campus, to deal with like a lot of problems that women face on campus, including regressive hostel timings and things like that. Also, reservation and of course, sexual harassment, right? To start with, like we recognize that limiting the conversation of sexual harassment to just the harassment itself and as well as just ICCs is a problem. When you start recognizing that it is several systemic things that go together to ensure that like campuses are made unsafe for women, right? So to start with, talking about privatization, right? So as and when hostels become more and more expensive, more students are forced to take PGs and flats, which open them up to far more other forms of violence, for instance, that often aren't dealt with by current ICCs, right? So with PG's hiking prices, A, universities themselves become more inaccessible to women students, but also like chances and instances of harassment increases. Beyond that, just talking a little bit about the culture of misogyny and sexual harassment that surrounds campuses. Like, although it's different from college to college and each college is its own case study, honestly, but beyond that, like what it's clearly evident is that most societies in colleges become boys clubs where you already have power dynamics. So a large part of the harassment we see as women going to these colleges occurs at after parties and things like that, where there is a distinct power dynamic that operates to ensure that it becomes tougher and tougher for women to actually take part in these or approach any redressal mechanism once something happens, right? Second is also the fact that like there exists unsafe infrastructure, for instance, that libraries maybe supposedly are 24/7 but are not accessible because of hostile timings. And the more and more like the response of the administration is to limit women's movement via things like installing CCTV cameras, which are often unreliable and don't actually serve the purpose and do not actually help in like ensuring women's mobility, because the lesser students you put on the street, the more unsafe it becomes. Case in point is apparently JNU had a lot of dhabas that were operational late into the night, which allowed like safe spaces for women to accumulate, to talk to each other, to discuss things, and made the streets just safer, right? But recently those dhabas were closed down, and with closing down of these avenues for women to just be on the streets and reclaim public spaces, it becomes that much more difficult to tackle like the more insidious structural problems that were with like sexual harassment, right? But a little bit about Pindra Todes, how we dealt with the problem. So basically, going back, there was a lot of campaigning around the time after which the Saksham Committee report came out. And while one of our biggest demands was implementation of ICCs in, for all colleges, we didn't really have a legal basis to ask for that without the UGC guidelines that then eventually came out. But the guidelines themselves were vague, and although they, it was great that they asked for elections to be held to these ICCs for student representatives, and they like it incorporated some aspects of the Saksham report, a big problem with them was, say, was things like filing false complaint, like attacking the complainant for filing a false complaint. So after a lot of deliberation on whether these guidelines were actually beneficial or not, it was eventually decided that this is at least a good first step to start. But then came the real problem, which was campaigning in colleges to allow any kind of like any actual implementation of what the guidelines said, right? So to start with, like I'll just give a couple of examples as I go along. So first, for instance, in Miranda House and in Khalsa and Stephens, for that matter, around the year 2016, 2017, the first ICCs came around, and it was a massive task to get, and even Daulat Ram, it was a massive task to get people to actually take it seriously enough to hold elections. As soon as admin found, like, got the circular from the UGC that mandated conducting these elections, it became really difficult because they tried to push it to happen in a very haphazard manner. So some colleges didn't even have elections. Some colleges had just professors saying that the like XYZ people are going to be appointed to the council, and you just have to be happy with it. After a lot of like trying, like for instance, in Stephens, just a couple of days before the elections, we got a circular saying we're looking for nominations. So there was hardly any time to campaign, hardly any time to actually draw any kind of awareness around what the ICC is and what like it's going to do to change the nature of sexual harassment on campus. But notwithstanding all these problems, there was still a lot of mobilization and a lot of campaigning and Jansun-wise and film screenings. And Pindra Todes used to meet every Thursday to discuss like what the next mode of operation should be. And I think like there are several things that affected the eventual outcome of these ICCs. First and foremost, what was most strongly represented by people who I reached out to who, from these colleges, was that there needed to be an active grassroots movement or a history of collective action within these university spaces. Without that kind of collective action, it was quite meaningless. In fact, ICCs were so heavily dependent on the history of collective action that once it was mandated, so we have this thing called Delhi University Students Union, which is like this huge election that happens for the union, and the student wings of a lot of political parties participate. What often happened is when ICC elections coincided with these DUSU elections, they were unnecessarily politicized. And when it did not, it was almost as if nobody really cared, and there was very little campaigning around it. So, but this was, and oftentimes like right wingers or people from the ruling regime who is not very feminist, I guess, and that's what I can say, often ended up like being elected to positions within the ICC, and that was really problematic. But this could be avoided with like a strong grassroots movement. So after submitting a bunch of memorandums and codes and everything to the proctor, when finally this happened, slowly that ability for a grassroots movement started evolving. And to be honest, the campaign that we had may not be like a very big mass movement within college. It's not like everybody was involved, but there were definitely like pockets of activism where a lot of people came out and decided that they'd had enough and that this was a necessity within college spaces to ensure safe spaces for women. Now about the ICCs themselves, right? So like one thing that Vinda talked about is of course the lack of sensitization of the people who then eventually went on. So think like it's a very visceral problem as students who are elected and who genuinely believe that sexual harassment is a problem and who want to help out, yet go into this committee with absolutely no training, which means often they lack any kind of background to deal with it. Also, you stop recognizing that a lot of these students have interpersonal relations with the people who are a complainant or accused. How do you deal with that outside of the committee and the inquiry of the committee? All of these things, like lack of fundamental, is a fundamental problem because these guidelines are very vague. And since there is no uniform code talking about what exactly should happen when the committee is constituted, the formal inquiry is left up to every college, which just leads to very haphazard processes in general, right? Other than that, like things like the professors often who are on these committees who are nominated, because we have no real idea about what positions or backgrounds they come from, often ends up like reinforcing these kind of stereotypes where they go ahead and call out survivors or ask them like insensitive questions. Like there should, like one of the things we've noticed is there is no real handbook on what you should be allowed to ask a survivor. So these questions are often insensitive and make them relive their trauma because of these problems. These committees are often pretty unsuccessful in really dealing with the kind of nuanced cases that come out in college campuses, right? And a big problem with the ICC is often because of a lack of understanding on how to incorporate methods of psychological counseling to people who then are recommended psychological counseling after a case. Often the focus is too much on carceral outcomes. So that means what ends up happening is ICCs often recommend some sort of punishment or punitive action because it becomes so difficult to, and also there is a lack of an understanding about how to have more rehabilitative forms of justice available to both the survivor as well as the respondent. So what happens is that it becomes, not only does it force complainants and respondents to start, character shaming and what Aisha was talking about, that it becomes a mess and there's a lot of slander everywhere. But beyond that, it just mimics existing social hierarchies, because what happens is when there is a threat to the career of the respondent, oftentimes universities decide to play it safe and with caution. So they decide that, it's not worth it just for a college case, which often, to draw that fine line between what is adequate punishment without what some would like then start screaming about being too much or carceral in nature, is becoming a really big part of like our arguments and discussions right now. And I think because the guidelines are so vague, it often doesn't recognize, so the lived experiences of caste and class and things like that, I don't think are very well incorporated. So when the respondent, the complainant is of a certain caste or class, I think that makes a very big difference, especially if the respondent is of a certain caste or class. So which means that to treat a Savarna Brahmin perpetrator the same as say a person suffering from a disability perpetrator, although I mean it becomes a question about the intent of the crime and the place from which that crime is committed, right? And I think those subtle nuances really lack. So while it is like we've come a long way from what we were, we still don't think we captured the like enormity of the nuance that exists in conversation around sexual harassment. Another big problem is that it becomes very tricky to actually talk about sexual harassment, because a lot of these ICC members are bound by silence and things like that, and like confidentiality, which is totally justified. But often there is like, what we see now is that there is no like mass movement that unites the struggles within different ICCs, if that's the right way to put it. So basically a while back we tried to have like a group with different representatives from different ICCs as well as professors who are involved in these issues and all of that, but it didn't really materialize eventually. Although we did draft up a new code for an ICC, it eventually didn't materialize because there was no follow-up as such. But because of this lack of communication within the different ICCs themselves and the kind of problems they face, that becomes like, it makes it very difficult for us to have like a ground movement, like a mass movement that actually involves everyone. Just noting a little bit from experiences of campaigning, what happened initially was a lot of people didn't understand like the language regarding sexual harassment, or the language in which we campaigned for ICCs was often very disconnected from the students who were studying at the time. So campaigning became very difficult, and most students were just like, what is the actual need for an ICC? Why should we care? What will it do to change our lived reality? So campaigning became really difficult because it was astounding, the general lack of awareness around an ICC. And it was especially difficult for students to understand why a university should still be concerned with its students, even if the act is happening off campus, and how you can still hold the university accountable. So things like that. And even around campaigning, it was so different campaigning from different, in a co-ed college and in an all-female college. Because in an all-female college, oftentimes violence, most of the male interaction that happens is with those in the working class. So conversations automatically start becoming more about like class differences and how and what that means, and how caste and class play a role in sexual harassment, versus say in co-ed schools where it was more around situational violence within classrooms and at parties and things like that. So I guess in terms of like the vast majority of our experiences, I think the one conclusion that most strongly stands out is that without any kind of grassroots movement, your institutions will fail, depending on a ruling government or depending on so many other factors, right? It's not strong enough to have an institutional mechanism which is not constantly policed by a grassroots movement of women who realize that they have a stake in this. And so it was, and that's how like continuous struggle has been happening, even at places like LAWFAC and at Stephens, where like the Anga Oath, which, just a little context, is another regressive
Aisha, I'm so sorry. I think you have a minute to just kind of wind up.
Anushka. But yeah, so I'll just wind up right now. So yeah, so basically, I lost my train of thought. But anyway, so yeah, so grassroots movement, yeah, Anga Oath. So basically, the only reason the Anga Oath was stopped in Stephens, it's a regressive tradition where on Valentine's Day, all these men line up and then they promise to uphold misogyny. And the only reason it was stopped was because like women mobilized on campus, same with in sex traditions in Hindu college and so on and so forth. So like larger questions, I think that still stand out is what then becomes like, although the suction committee report and the Vishaka guidelines and everything were like landmark in their own right, I think like our experience is that there needs to be a new understanding of what it is to be a woman and what kind of harassment a woman undergoes, especially the specific nature of harassment that a college going urban woman undergoes while coming to a university to maybe study for the first time away from home, right? And also what kind of like what is the actual scope of institutional mechanisms, how to pivot away from carceral outcomes of these institutional mechanisms, and like how things like Me Too, which also like led to several conversations in college, how all of that changes. And another, of course, important thing like is conversations around sexual harassment discuss what exactly constitutes sexual harassment, including like new things like what breach of trust is and whether that is in fact sexual harassment or whether that constitutes more of sexism or misogyny or just like from a place of power, and whether or not we can change our articulation around discomfort, which means coordination between things like the STSC cell or the Northeast cell, which deals with racism and discrimination against scheduled tribes and castes or people from the Northeast, and sexual harassment as well. So the intersections of all of these different types of harassments and like is really important, which is why these committees need to like sort of start, and even in engaging unions, because what like we see is that the administration keeps trying to keep ICCs and sexual harassment in this box where it is uninfluenced by all of these other things that happen in campus, which is just not true, which promotes like which ensures that there can't be any mass mobilization. Once you break out of that, I start realizing that each of these things are dependent on each other. Simply things like street lights or open bars, what infrastructure we can do to help sexual harassment along with like changing ICCs. So yeah, basically that.
Thank you so much, you know, for speaking from your lived experiences and for bringing the intersections to the fore, right? Talking about the kind of the humongous challenges that ICs face and how the entire process can be derailed. And I'm so happy that you have also told us how grassroots movement can, if students are invested and empowered, and I think if they take up these issues, it'll make a difference somewhere. So thank you so much. Once again, I would like to thank all the panelists, and I can see several questions in the chat box, and probably Adrija will help me in moderating the session. First to you, Aisha, I think, I'll put these questions together. There are these three related questions about GS Cash. One which says that, were the upheld outcomes then made public after the end of an inquiry? This is one of the questions. Should I tell you all three and then you can respond to them?
Yeah.
And the second is that, were there considerations made for members of LGBTQI? I think you did refer to this as being a very gender-specific law. Also, what was done to sensitize the members of GS Cash?
Right. So, what? Because confidentiality for the complainant had to be maintained, and so the specific acts weren't made. But this gave, every inquiry was followed by public notices. There were regular newsletters, which talked about the implications of, without referring to a particular case. The man's name would obviously be made public because they actually got the university to dismiss, I think, about 10 employees over these 18 years. But we would talk, for example, just to give you one example, I remember one of the first students to be terminated from the university for repeatedly sending pornography to a woman student. She herself has written about it. I'll find the link and post it in the chat box. So it gave us an opportunity to discuss pornography. Right? So related to the other questions, so similarly with, all kinds of quid pro quo situations. We got, and even inquiries that didn't result in punishment, we took because it was common knowledge. I mean, at least in the first 2 years, people would follow complaints, and it's a small place, so people would know. But we would be able to discuss a number of issues and where are the lines. That was very important for us. the lines between sexual harassment and sexual assault. We didn't want everything to end up being called sexual harassment because definitions were vague in Vishakha too. And so that we didn't, what was a criminal offense, but what was the role of the community committee? We departed from Vishakha right from the very beginning. This was a big issue and we had to fight a lot about this, saying this is a gender plural law. Remember, homosexuality was a criminal offense when we started. But one of the greatest joys for us was the fact that almost immediately after the birth of G.S. Keshe, the first LGBTQI group in JNU was formed, which drew explicit support from the fact that G.S. Keshe recognized people as subjects to sexual harassment. I myself have been part of inquiries where actually people have been punished for same-sex harassment. But we were always careful not to foreground it in the first few years, because a sexual advance would be reported in such cases as a sexual harassment exercise. So I think that generally people are happy. Were people trained? Yes, so one of the things that elections did, and because every case in the first few years certainly was a matter of intense discussion, and G.S. Keshe did made no attempt to actually stop people from discussing, but not to discuss the specific of the cases. And the election process actually involved a lot of training. Then if you would look at the G.S. Keshe rules and procedures, I has posted the link. I mean, they were a sensitization exercise in themselves about, so some of the problems that Anushka was mentioning, you know, what can you ask? You could not ask a single question about the past sexual history of the woman. You could not ask, you could not deny her the presence of a supporter. So just the rules and procedures of the G.S. Keshe, which involved huge discussions, because the whole university framed them. It wasn't, there were meetings of, you know, literally hundreds of people, and because G.S. Keshe would make a draft of the rules and procedures, and we would take it to the public, and then there would be public meetings organized just to discuss it. So that, I think that the first 3-4 years that burst created huge awareness. In fact, there was a study done by a foreign student saying that people in JNU seem to know what was sexual harassment. We're still living off that. And people became tenderly. So it was very exciting time, very tiring. And of course, but one thing I want to say, so, you know, what has happened is that the UGC guidelines, which are only remotely based on the Saksham guideline, have created another institutional mechanism, which is something like a halfway house, where there is the illusion that there is a body, but there, it doesn't produce anything, which anywhere remotely like the questions of justice. Because these committees cannot, they're only punitive bodies, they are not sensitization bodies. So the great work that Pinjara Tor is doing is, you know, in some sense, these questions were discussed and invented and settled in the first phase of Delhi University anti-sexual harassment committees, because the same questions that we had in JNU, Delhi University had. And they were resolved in whatever ways that, you know, were suited to particular colleges. And, you know, so it's a great tragedy, but it's also shows that, you know, the questions don't die. I mean, particular structures may die. Of course, if we were to redo a G.S. Keshe now, it wouldn't be the same composition with just the same kind of questions. We would have different constituencies that are members. But it was a beginning, and it was always an open document, so you could keep on changing it until the UGC guidelines came and destroyed us, actually. So that was the pretext that we used to shut us down.
Thank you, Aisha. I think there's a related question, and this is something that both of you can take up, both Aisha and Brinda. Geeta Chadda asks this question, and she says, if G. Keshe was a feminist act, which it indeed was, it requires a feminist consciousness to implement it. It is extremely difficult to implement the present law and the UGC guidelines in 750 colleges like a university, like Mumbai University, when feminist consciousness is on decline within the academia. Could we possibly think of implementing it as a basic mechanism that anyone can actually implement, provided it is built on the principle of giving the complainant the first benefit of doubt? And Geeta heads the WDC at University of Mumbai. So I think both of you can take this up and in whichever order you want.
Vrinda, why don't you go first?
Vrinda, please. Yes,
let me try and then Aisha can chip in. I couldn't agree more that you need a feminist consciousness to take these statutes forward. I don't see the present sexual harassment law, which I actually have many, it irks me in multiple ways, apart from the boss getting to decide the committee. There are many, many things in it which are problematic. So I don't see statutes as feminist. I see our processes that we can evolve through them as being part of our feminist consciousness. And yes, you can't. So let me take a parallel, Geeta. So every office, every workplace will have a departmental proceeding process, which is there for, from a government office to every university will have to have it, because their and sexual harassment, as we know, was included into the government rules of what is defined as misconduct. Misconduct can be somebody embezzling money, to somebody slapping someone, or somebody just not turning up for work for 3 months. All those would require some form of departmental proceedings, which are part and parcel of every workplace law. And misconduct sexual harassment was included as a form of misconduct. Where it departed from there was then to say, okay, this can't work in the regular departmental proceeding manner, and a separate committee and separate process. Now, the issue here is that sexual harassment is not, it's not just a statement of fact. It's not that you didn't come for 3 months to office. Now, that can really be proven directly whether you did or you didn't. There's not much to be interpreted out there. But the nature of sexual harassment requires a different way of understanding it. And therefore, I cannot but agree with you more that it will require a feminist consciousness. However, I don't see this as a chicken and egg story. I think both, there is an interplay between them. I think when you start these processes, that consciousness begins and evolves and grows for everybody around you once this conversation begins. So I would not wait for the feminist consciousness, which yes, goes through its own ups and downs. And I think it's part of what is happening to democracy in general in this country. And I suppose, and I hope we are all going to live to see it turn around. And I think we should just keep plodding at it.
Yeah, so I would completely concur with Avinda. I think that, there were many solutions that followed the GS Cash kind of solution, which were tailored to different circumstances. So every place it's not possible to do an election. So fine, it's not possible. But the question of a populace that is to be represented on the committee, that the committee is representative of who's on the workplace, in the workspace, that certainly has to be a live issue, right? So that, if there is going to be only the senior woman HR manager, right? And she's not the person who's going to complain about sexual harassment. She might be harassed, but she might not complain about it. I mean, there's only been one or two Rupan Deol Bajajis in our life, right? So I think that who is to represent? And what is the simple mechanism when the reality is complex? So I think one thing that Anushka said, how can you have a range of penalties? It's simplest to say dismiss, terminate. The kind of punishments that the GS Cash gave were including becoming a volunteer for GS Cash. So that you change people's mindsets. We know that we all, this is, and for none of us, that process of becoming feminist has ended. right? So there is no teenology that, okay, now I'm sensitized. No, I'm not sensitized. I do not, it's an individual grievance. There's an individual dispute. So there is no simple solution. But there are principles of fairness that should be articulated, and a principle of who we are looking at, the redresser, not the punishment of sexual harassment. I mean, that was the perspective that we took, that there was an institutional wrong, that the institution was implicated. And those very principles are now absent in the way that we look at sexual harassment. I know this was a casual comment, but the idea that we will approach a complaint with doubt and then, you know, say, okay, let the woman be heard. It's just a you first approach.
You're not sure the fuck up, bitch.
Sorry? Oh, okay.
I think that's the problem with a public link. I've just kicked the person out.
Okay, all right. Sorry, I understand what you're saying. But we had the liberty in the first round of anti-sexual harassment committees to think of what mechanism suited the problem. Not that it was something that was universally implemented. And therefore then was just one size that fits nobody.
Thank you, Aisha. Brinda, this is for you. And it says, I just lost it. Just give me like 30 seconds. It was talking about, yes. Can a complaint of rape or grievous sexual assault be inquired into by ICs through civil procedure? I think we just, the organizers need to remove. All right. Shall I continue? Okay. So, Vrinda, here is a question. Never mind. Can a complaint of rape or grievous sexual assault be inquired into by ICs through civil procedures, especially if a complainant does not wish to go to the police?
Okay, so this is a question that has been asked many times. There is no, I can only give you how I read the law. There is no authoritative answer. And because here the IPC and the CRPC and the section. Oh, please, can this character keep quiet? There is no, we've not had like a decision of that kind. Clearly somebody wishes to disrupt the conversation, so we'll just talk louder. I would say that if there is a sexual assault, because of the interface between the Code of Criminal Procedure, the IPC and the sexual harassment law today, a sexual assault here, I am using the term sexual assault, does not exist in the IPC, it exists in POCSO. I'm using the word rape here. If it is a case of rape, then it is something that is best sent to the police. And here there are obligations to support the woman, taking her into confidence. If she wishes to go to the police, the obligation on the institution is not to say, okay, now you go to the police because the police will handle it. It is to see, does she want to go to the police? What does she need from the institution? Does she need leave? Does she need a lawyer? Does she need people to accompany her? Does she need handholding through the entire process? Those are responsibilities that the sexual harassment law does thrust upon the employer. It's not just to say, this is not our job. This is not the ICC's remit. You go to the cops. That's not what the law says. But my opinion, those should be handed over for investigation if the woman is feeling confident in taking it forward. I'm not one for throwing women into the criminal legal system without them agreeing to the process. So I would personally say that it should go there. The consequences of just doing an inquiry can be very mixed. invariably the crime can have lesser and bigger offenses. There may be prior incidents of harassment, which you can perhaps look into and then see what kind of measures need to be taken. I'm just going to take one second more to say, there are many instances which everyone who's engaged with this issue has run into where you know something has happened, but the woman, for many reasons, is not willing to come forward. And then very often it's said, oh, what is the committee meant to do? I don't think the committee is powerless or has no options. There are multiple ways in which you can begin a conversation, you can increase her level of confidence,